every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, the author of the novel Love Marriage.
So this is it. Our last chance to offer a referendum on the Trump administration before 2020. This is our elections episode before the midterms. Are you excited or terrified?
Can I be both?
Yes. Well, and probably a bunch of other things like most of our listeners. Just to clarify the polling situation for all of our readers who aren't refreshing 538 every 20 minutes, the Democrats are heavily favored to win control of the House, according to their model, while the Republicans are heavily favored to retain control of the Senate. That's basically where things stand.
And of course, we know that this is not the kind of stuff that anybody listens to our podcast to find out. You have lots of other sources for that. But what you do listen for, we hope, are guests who can talk politics and literature, because and I don't know if you've noticed our policy change this week. We believe that every issue, not nearly every
issue.
Yeah,
we're getting rid of the qualifier
issue,
on that.
we've gone extreme. Every issue has already been covered somewhere in literature. So we have with us a couple of great guests who can help us understand and talk about how literature can cover something as momentous as this year's midterms, every bit as much as the polls.
And for that, fortunately, we have two perfect guests. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking to Alexander Chi, the author most recently of How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, who last appeared on the podcast to talk to us about Facebook. And right now, we're going to get the lowdown on the current status of the race for the House and Senate from the writer Jane Costin. Jane is a senior politics reporter at Vox and a co-host on Vox's hugely popular podcast, The Weeds, where I listen to her every week. She has also written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, ESPN, and The Ringer. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So one of your areas of expertise is conservatism, and not just alt and extreme right conservatism, though you do frequently write about that, but also Black conservatism. And a few weeks ago, you wrote a review of Max Boot's book, The Corrosion of Conservatism, that was also a powerfully argued history of how Black conservatives left the Republican Party in the 60s. Could you talk to us about what led you to write that piece and maybe read a little bit from it?
Sure. So I was really interested in, I talk a lot to conservatives, and I'm very interested in conservatives who are kind of reconsidering their own relationship with conservatism, because I think it's important to be clear that there, when we talk about conservatism, we are not inherently talking about the Republican Party. And for a lot of conservatives, their relationship with conservatism is very much of a personal one. For example, people are not Republicans or people are not conservatives because they want to be tied to like the things that Richard Nixon did, but they are conservatives and Republicans, the same way anyone experiences a political awakening. For example, Max Boot wrote a lot about his own childhood as an immigrant from the Soviet Union, and talked about like what he found in conservatism. But I was kind of struck by the fact that he seemed to be coming to these conclusions about the GOP's relationships with race that African American conservatives came to 50 years ago.
I liked that lead where you're like, half a century after many others figured this out.
Right. And so I think that there very much was a sense within the book that, he's coming to terms with this, he's getting into this, he's recognizing this. But even while he's talking about these figures, we're not kind of coming back to this with the spirit of, no one had any idea. People knew. And so, I'll read a bit from a portion from the book that I feature in the article. And so this is Max Boot writing, and he writes, "In 1964, the GOP ceased to be the party of Lincoln and became the party of Southern whites. As I now look back with the clarity of hindsight, I am convinced that coded racial appeals had at least as much, if not more, to do with the electoral success of the modern Republican Party than all of the domestic and foreign policy proposals crafted by well-intentioned analysts like me. This is what liberals have been saying for decades. I never believed them." And so it was interesting to me that he parsed out this idea that, liberals had been saying this, that, but that he just hadn't heard it. But, that wasn't true. These were, African Americans like, Jackie Robinson were saying in 1964, they were talking about these issues at the time. And so I'll just read a little bit from the piece. This is at Black conservatives and Black Republicans who are seeing the whitening of the Republican Party and the increased racial extremism of the conservatives conservative movement. And so they're protesting outside the 1964 Republican National Convention and lobbying Republican leaders. And you know, one man wrote in a letter to the New York Amsterdam News, any Negro who helps the cause of Goldwater, Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican nominee in 1964, should be declared anything but a Negro because they will be a traitor to the Negro people. And so I think that they're very much with this sense that people, you know, Jackie Robinson went to the 1964 convention where, you know, one man tried to fight him. And his, you know, I write, it's an excerpt from his autobiography from 1972 called I Never Had It Made. And he talks about being at the convention. It was a terrible hour for the relatively few black delegates who were present, distinguished in their communities, identified with the cause of republicanism, an extremely unpopular cause among blacks. They had been served notice that the party they had fought for considered them just another bunch of niggers. They had no real standing in the convention, no club. They were unimportant and ignored. And so, you know, this is what conservatives were talking about. This is what black conservatives were talking about in the early 1960s. And it just, I found it so striking that Max Boot did not appear to know this, and also that a lot of people didn't know this. A lot of people don't know this. That this is the conversation about, one, the relationship between conservatism and the Republican Party, and two, the relationship between black conservatives, black Republicans, and the Republican Party is something people have been contesting and arguing about and discussing for, you know, more than 50 years.
Well, when I read your piece, I thought of, I mean, you know, we're a literary show and a news show, and I thought of the father and the sort of Greek chorus of female congregation members in Britt Bennett's novel, The Mothers, and we've had Britt on the show, or Tracy K. Smith's father in her memoir, Ordinary Light, or even the narrator in Paul Beatty's novel, The Sellout, you know. So this concept of black conservatism is present in literature, but you just, it does not, in the contemporary media or thinking of the way people think about the conservative movement, it is not. Is it just because contemporary media is mostly white, you know, or is there some other explanation for that?
I think so, and especially because I think it's very difficult for people to parse out politics that doesn't work on a standard kind of left-right spectrum. Uh-huh. For example, talking about people who might hold conservative religious views but vote Democrat, or talking about people who are, you know, hardcore libertarians and think that the state shouldn't be involved in anything but still vote Republican. Because I think that, you know, there's how you feel and how you vote are two different things for many people. And I think that trying to make sense of that and trying to make sense of, you know, how black voting works and black political involvement has worked, it doesn't tend to work in a way that would be easily parsed out in a soundbite on television. And so I think, yes, you know, the concept of black conservatism is, it's something that people inherently, you know, people know about this. And so, you know, before obviously everything that happened, Bill Cosby was kind of espousing these ideals of a personal form of black conservatism, that, you know, if we just act right, good things will happen. And I think that's not new. And so you see that even in the early 1900s, you see that from figures like Marcus Garvey, you know, with this argument that like black uprising and black uplift, you know, not having anything to do with the government, but if we just are really good people, then someday good things will happen to us. And, you know, it's challenging because I think that it's been, I think in some ways, there's a sense of black conservatism and black republicanism being two distinct things. And, you know, we talked about this. There was a Weeds episode. I'm going to let you finish.
Yeah, that was a great episode.
Kanye
West. Talk about Kanye. That was, I'd love our listeners to hear some of the stuff you had to say on that.
Well, I think that, I mean, one of the biggest things I tried to make the point of is that this is not Kanye West espousing conservatism. This is not Kanye West being, you know, after a great deal of thought and looking at kind of a Burkean analysis of political theory. You know, I've come to believe that the government is more standing in the way of true freedom than acting as a thoroughfare. No, that's not what he's doing. This is, you know, and there's a view of conservatism in 2018 as anti-left, that it is, that's the only thing, is that basically, like, if the left says jump, you say don't. If the left says go right, you turn left. Like, it's reactionary.
Right.
And so I think that's what you're seeing. You know, that's what you're seeing kind of from the Candace Owenses of the world and Turning Point USA, this idea of like conservatism as whatever Democrats are not doing. And so it's actually, you know, it's a really shallow and hollow form of conservatism, because it all depends on operating on an axis that is the opposite of whatever someone else is saying. You know, it is, it cannot operate in a vacuum. And I think, you know, a political ideology, and I know that ideology is a very unpopular word right now with a lot of people, but a political ideology needs to be able to operate without any other political ideologies around it. You know, there are a lot of conservatives and a lot of liberals that would be conservative or liberal if no one else was around. Uh-huh. And yet the kind of conservatism we see in, you know, from Kanye or from this type of conservatism, it only operates in opposition to something else.
I'm assuming that in this, just to bring us back to the election at hand that's going to be happening next Tuesday, I'm assuming that still the Democratic candidates will get a huge percentage of the black vote. So none of these things that Kanye is doing or this Turning Point group that Trump was addressing just the other day is actually affecting this election. But is it going to affect the future in some point? Can you say how this will affect electoral politics going forward?
I personally don't think so, because I think it's a very, I like to talk about people who are quote unquote very online. And Turning Point USA is very online. It gets a lot of funding and they're very busy on Twitter, and they get a lot of funding from like older, generally white conservatives. But in terms of, you know, what people are actually interested in terms of voting, it's very difficult. And I think we've seen this, Democrats saw this earlier. It is very difficult to start a political movement that's all based on either a long lasting political movement that's either based on a specific personality or an opposition to something else. And I'll take opposition first. You know, one of the challenges with in 2004 was that a lot of people kind of saw the, you know, voting for John Kerry as not necessarily voting for John Kerry, but voting against George W. Bush. And so that kind of politics of opposition, it's easy, but it's difficult in a way. And it's easy to explain. Difficult, it's difficult to kind of keep people on board for. And also, you know, a conservatism that's based inherently on support, being supportive of Donald Trump, you know, what happens without Donald Trump? And, you know, there is no replacement for him. There was this kind of idea of like, yes, you know, people who voted for Trump are going to vote for Mike Pence. And that's not how this is going to work. They appeal to extremely different audiences. And so I think that I don't think it's going to have a big impact, also because this is something, you know, Turning Point's the kind of thing that I know about and you know about and your listeners might know about. But, you know, I like to joke, you know, my parents live in Ohio, and I like to occasionally do this thing I call the mom test, where I call my parents and ask, like, have you heard about this thing? And they never have heard of it. And, you know, these are pretty with it people in their mid to late 60s, early 70s, who are following the news and understand, you know, but if you're following the news, you're reading the New York Times and occasionally watching ABC News. This isn't, you know, and to understand Turning Point takes a little bit more of a deep dive into a very strange political world.
Well, I know, Sugi, we need to move on to the next question, but I think we should maybe just define Turning Point in case there are some moms there.
Yeah. So Turning Point USA is a conservative campus organization. They're actually very controversial among other conservative campus groups, because they tend to do things that, for instance, at Kent State, there was an instance in which a bunch of students, like, they had this whole protest where everyone wore diapers.
Okay.
And it just was the kind of thing that basically, it's the kind of thing, I know it sounds like I am making this up. I am not. The kind of thing, it's very trolly. It's very like, all they want really is attention. Like, this is not about trying to like raise the next generation of young Republicans. You know, this isn't Young Americans for Freedom. This isn't, you know, your campus Republicans. But they do tend to get a lot of attention. And so, you know, they're an attention grabbing campus organization.
Yes, there's an internet spiral out there for those of you who want to go on it and don't know about Turning Point USA. But I also am so interested to hear you talk about specifically the midterms. And so only a few weeks ago, everyone was postulating that the Kavanaugh hearings were going to be crucial to the midterms. And in the past week, we've seen a shocking series of events, including the bombs allegedly sent by Cesar Sayoc to prominent Democrats and media figures, and the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. And does any of this affect the state of the race in the House and Senate now, just speaking in purely callous horse race terms?
So it's actually really funny. Dave Weigel, who is a reporter for The Washington Post, he's on Twitter. He put up, you know, if you just looked at 538's calculations of the House race, you would think this has been the most boring 2 months in like the last decade, because nothing has changed. And so I think that in horse race terms, and you know, I think that's a really challenging way to look at politics, because we have no idea. And I think, you know, I really want people to start embracing saying that you have no idea about something. We have no idea how individual events affect how people vote. For example, a lot of people have drawn attention to the Comey letter right before the 2016 presidential election, and whether or not that affected vote totals. However, we still don't know how that impacted how people voted, or whether people voted, or whether that motivated some people or demotivated some people. There's been some research on the subject, but it's still not clear. So I think that it's really hard to say whether or not that'll affect, you know, it looks generally as if the Democrats will win the House and the Republicans will keep the Senate. But again, we don't know. Honestly, you know, I think that we've seen historically that, especially for midterms, the weather the day of the election will probably play a bigger role than current events. Because, I mean, it's, again, but it's really hard to say.
So, okay, let's just assume, and again, that's one of the weird things about talking about this midterm is it seems like such a momentous thing. It's the first time for people to vote sort of nationally since Trump was elected, and yet it has been a boring race and has sort of sat in the same place. So let's assume it's going to happen the way the polls say. What else should or could we be following in this election that would be significant or meaningful for the future?
I think something that's interesting is looking at Democrats who are running in state and local elections and kind of the language that they're using. I think that something I've said before on other podcasts and in my writing is that Democrats are kind of re-embracing federalism and really embracing the localization of politics. And I think they're doing that to their benefit. So, example, during the special elections last year, and then during the elections in Virginia in late 2017, you saw candidates winning office in Virginia who basically were like, yes, you know, I'm a liberal Democrat, but basically all I want to talk about is this specific issue that has to do with where I'm running, whether it be traffic, whether it be healthcare. And you're seeing people who, you know, I think that a lot of Republicans were kind of convinced that Democrats were running a very anti-Trump Russia, Russia, Russia campaign. The number one subject Democrats are discussing in these midterm elections is healthcare. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, they are spending millions and millions of dollars on advertising on the subject of healthcare. And, you know, when the kind of Twitterati people who talk, you know, like, why aren't you talking about Trump enough? Or are you talking about Trump too much? That they're not really talking about Trump at all. You know, and they're seeing some gains because, one, people do want, a, you know, even we've seen this even with independent voters, that they do want someone to be a check on Donald Trump. But also that, you know, when you are not enmeshed in the news cycle all the time, people are not as interested in talking about the machinations of Donald Trump. They are very interested in how much they had to pay for health care. So I think looking at how Democrats are talking about local and state issues and the types of issues they're talking about is of deep interest. And especially because that will be, for a lot of Democrats, how they start workshopping what they might want to bring into a 2020 presidential race, perhaps.
And that's also, I mean, going back to what you were saying before, just a much more sustainable way of getting people on board. I mean, as if they were sort of employing more reactionary politics, that wouldn't really work as well. I'm curious to hear you talk about the way the GOP has been using immigration and the caravan and MS-13 in the election, which seems related to your discussion of Jackie Robinson and the way the conservative Black voters abandoned the GOP in the 60s. And there have been several articles kind of talking about why Latinx voters haven't been turning out more strongly for Democrats. And I wonder, is it that Latinx voters also have a significant conservative bloc and they haven't had their Goldwater moment yet? Or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's more complicated than that, because what you are seeing is, for one thing, there has seemed to be, for many Latinx voters in California and elsewhere, there is, how best to put this, there's been kind of a shifting understanding of how, identity plays into how people vote. So, for example, first of all, a big issue is a lot of Latina Americans aren't registered to vote and don't vote. And, you know, I think that that's a big issue, and that's an outrage issue for Democrats and for Republicans. But I also think that for African Americans, there has been decades and decades of seeing their voices squelched out of the Republican Party. While I think that for, you know, we see Latina and Latino conservatives, and there has been a sense, a greater sense, I think, by the GOP that, and it's a funny line to walk, because on the one hand, you see people, you know, demonizing undocumented immigrants and talking about MS-13 and the caravan. But then you also see this idea of like, no, that like they're, but then they're the good immigrants. And these are the good ones who did it, quote unquote, the right way. And you see this weird kind of the changings in the personification of what an immigrant is. And so I think that, you know, Latina conservatism, and I don't mean conservatism as in like political conservatism, I mean like generally tending to be more religious, and that certain issues that Democrats put forward as being deeply important to them are not something that maybe for some Latinos that's something that they feel as well. But I also think that it's, you know, as I said, an outreach issue. But again, it's complicated. It's very complicated. And I feel as if it does a disservice, I think, to both groups to attempt to compare the experiences of African Americans and Latino Americans, because it's the experiences of African Americans in the United States have to be seen through the lenses of, you know, slavery and Jim Crow, and how the Republican Party worked, you know, how the Republican Party benefited in some ways from de jure segregation and from, you know, you kind of see the Southern strategy. There hasn't been, quote unquote, a Southern strategy when it comes to Latino voters. And, you know, right. we saw in the GOP 2012 autopsy how they wanted to do better outreach. And it's fascinating because on the one hand, you see this demonization through Trump of Latino voters. But on the other hand, you see this outreach taking place from the GOP. But moreover, the biggest thing, you know, I often talk about one of the biggest things you need to do in a campaign is you need to motivate your voters, but demotivate their voters. And so I think in states like Texas and elsewhere, where you think, you know, oh, people have been like, oh, there are so many Latino voters here, some of them have not been motivated. And in fact, they've been demotivated from getting involved in the political process.
So, Lucan, I really appreciated your piece for Vox on the history of false flag claims in relationship to attacks like the shootings in Pittsburgh and the bombings that Cesar Sayoc carried out. One of the things we've discussed very frequently on the show over the past year has been a sense that an interest in facts has kind of gone out the window, particularly in the conservative alt-right world. Could anything happen on Tuesday that would ameliorate this problem, you know, or is it something that elections can't or won't affect? I mean, would, like, if there was a huge Democratic sweep, would suddenly the alt-right be interested in facts, or is that just a stupid idea and that's why I'm laughing even as I say it?
Well, I think that something that's important to note is that, you know, I like to think of myself as a student of history, even though that's a ridiculous phrase and I shouldn't have said it. But
it's better than not being a student of history.
It's true. But historically, we are not actually that interested in facts as a species. You know, I often think about, you know, one of my favorite eras of history to think about is, you know, between the 1890s to the 1920s, and actually really having a resurgence again after World War One and the experience of the horrors of World War One, is there is a outright mysticism craze. People lost it. Like, people want to go see mediums. Mediums would do things like fake vomiting, like this plasma that they would be like, oh, it's ghosts. And people are like, oh, that looks like ghosts. And, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, was absolutely convinced in the existence of fairies and could not be convinced otherwise, even when shown that a lot of the photographs he'd been using as the basis for his evidence were clearly faked by small children. You know, there has actually never been a time at which we were all unified on the concept of facts, because, again, you know, there's that Talking Head song, Cross-Eyed and Painless, that talks about facts just get twist the truth around, facts are getting me inside out. That a lot of people, when confronted with, and I think this happens I think this happens to all of us, that if you believe something and someone says, well, according to the facts, that's not true, that does not make you stop believing it for a lot of people. I mean, that's actually, you know, I've written about how conspiracy theories work. And it turns out just proving a conspiracy theory only makes the person who believes the conspiracy theory believe it more, because they're convinced that you're trying to keep something from them. And so, you know, and that relates to the fact that my, you know, I kind of have theorized that conspiracy theories are more like religious belief systems than based on like facts and evidence. You know, people do not become 9/11 truthers because like that, they're like, ah, yes, I've considered everything. You know, they go to resources that tell them already that 9/11 didn't happen in a certain way. And then, you know, they use those as their backing, and because it makes them feel better. It's a feelings thing. It has nothing to do with facts. But so I would say that in general, we've never really been very big on facts, like as humans.
That exact point is like one of the reasons that one of the not often talked about reasons why I think Trump is so popular with evangelical Christians, because the way that Trump handles like, you know, belief systems and facts and faith, really, you know, not faith in God, but faith in him, or in faith in what you're going to believe, regardless of whatever kind of evidence, you know, people bring forward in terms of scientific evidence, is very familiar to evangelical community, at least in my experience of that community.
Right. I think, and again, this is something, I think there's been a tendency for people who are not religious believers to think about this and very like, this is something I couldn't happen to me. It's psychological as much as anything, because you see this happen with people who are very much, you know, who pride themselves on kind of their scientific bona fides, that in order to continue to believe something, they will disregard any evidence that disproves it, and they will find any evidence that will prove it. And so I think that it's really important to think about this way, about how politics has become, it's less of a fact-seeking mission and more of a belief system for many people.
Yeah, and listening to you talk, I'm also reminded of, we're talking about, you know, people ignoring fact and history, which is something that Marilyn Robinson, when she goes around talking about kind of our present politics, will often remind us that we're sort of ahistorical in the ways that we think about like American goodness, which is an optimism I'm kind of clinging to at the moment. And I'm also reminded of, you know, I went to journalism school, and the novel that we read at journalism school was Journal of a Plague Year by Daniel Defoe, which a lot of people, when it came out, just like thought was it's, you know, the history of the plague in London, and people believe it. And when we read it, we sort of read it as part of the history of the presentation of fact. And it was interesting to think about in that way. And I'm curious, because we're going to talk about politics and literature with the writer Alexander Chi in a moment. I'm really curious to hear you invoked a couple of writers there. If you could talk to us a little bit more about the novels, essays, and poems that led you to become a political writer, and if there are works of fiction or poetry that you return to today when you're looking to get some perspective on our present situation.
Well, I have to tell you, and I thought about this question, and I decided it was best to just be honest. I never read fiction. It's actually one of my great failings. For some reason, I just don't. But I would say that, you know, this is going to sound funny, but actually the book, it's a two-part book, Mouse by Art Spiegelman.
That's a great book of literature.
I read that for the first time when I was 9 years old, and that changed my life.
Nine's a little early for that, but I...
My father was a librarian, and so he would just bring books home, and I just started it, and that's where everything for me, in terms of my interest in both kind of far-right fringe movements and in just kind of trying to make sense of things that don't make sense, I think that's where it really began for me. But actually, you know, I would appreciate from you or any listeners any works of fiction I can get into, because at a certain point, you know, you should see my desk here at Vox is just books about Nazis and books about the Holocaust and books about white supremacy and books about criminal justice reform. And it's a personal challenge. I'm aware that I have a personal limitation that I do not read fiction, and it is not a good thing about me. I know that.
Well, now it's the confessions episode. I mean, I think people could scarcely criticize you for citing Mouse, which is one of the most brilliant. I mean, that book, I feel like, which is rightfully taught so much, I think has been influential for so many people.
If you like graphic novels, you could try Persepolis.
I've started Persepolis and then I got distracted and have not yet finished it. That is another, I'm just going to tell you all, I have challenges with finishing things sometimes, especially books that I should finish.
I don't know. I think that books are, you know, you should only read them if you want to. I start books all the time and throw them on the floor and don't finish them. That's kind of, I don't think anybody should be forced to read a book that they don't want to read.
Well, I appreciate your support.
Are you a rereader? Do you go back to Mouse?
I reread a lot. I think that that's something that I do pretty often. I find that very comforting, especially to reread words that I have had in my head for a long time. And I think that that's something, you know, at home we have a pretty extensive bookshelf, but there's a bunch of books on there just I haven't yet touched. And then there are so many books I just go back to again and again.
And what are some of those?
I think this is going to sound funny, but there's, her name is Mary Roach, and she writes about science. I kind of tidbits about science, and I just find her work so interesting because she talks about sex and death and the corpses and the military, but she does such in such a human fashion that I find that that's something I want to emulate in my writing, making things that are terrible make sense, even if they do not inherently make sense. And so I think that that's something that I really, you know, when you're a writer, it's really helpful to read other writing from someone else just to get out of your own head or see how they approach something. And I found that that's been really helpful.
Well, we should definitely have included creative nonfiction on the list. It was prejudiced by Sugi and I to not include that form since we both teach it as well. And it's just the same as fiction or poetry. All right. The time has come, Jane. Your predictions for Tuesday. What's going to happen?
So, again, I believe that we should all embrace the power of saying, I have no idea. So I'm going to say, I have no idea. Because we don't know, you know, what if there's a random, you know, a lightning storm in Georgia or like floods in Utah or something happens. And so after 2016, I just got out of the business of trying to predict anything. I think voter turnout will be very, very high. I think that's about all I'm willing to say.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jane. And we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this. And we encourage our listeners to check out your work on Vox and on Vox's excellent and informative podcast, The Weeds, where you were joined by Ezra Klein, Dara Lind, Matt Iglesias, and Sarah Cliff.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
We're thrilled to have Alexander Chi here to talk with us about the midterms, activism, and political writing. Alexander is the author of two novels, The Queen of the Night and Edinburgh. His essays and stories have appeared in Tin House, Slate, and Guernica, among other places. And his most recent book is the amazing essay collection, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, which Publishers Weekly just named one of its 10 best books of 2018. Alexander, welcome back to the podcast, and congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'm really pleased about it.
It's great to have you, and that's a well-deserved honor for that book. As the novelist Mohsin Hamid says in a recent New York Times Bookends interview, fiction writers who claim their writing is not political are simply writers who seek to disassociate themselves from the politics furthered by their writing. Alexander, your most recent book of essays deals partly with your experience as an activist. Could you talk a little bit about that and about the ways in which you think of this new essay collection as a political book, or about how you understand this relationship between the personal and the political?
Sure. I was teaching a story the other day by a former student of mine whose first story was published in One Story and then nominated for the Kane Prize. Her name is F.T. Kola. And it was an interesting experience to be reading that with my students and have them observing how each sentence of that story, it's called A Party for the Colonel, details for the reader this very complicated relationship that South Asians had to apartheid in South Africa at the time, and their role as a kind of essentially an aid to the white power structure there, while never actually also experiencing like full liberation in relationship to that. So always the promise of like having at least more than say Black South Africans, and it's an incredibly political story in just about every sentence. And in every sentence, it is always in the the descriptions of the ways in which people speak to each other. And I'm incredibly proud of that story for her. And it was thrilling for me to see at the time, because it also you know, is relevant to the way in which I think Asian Americans now, Asian American activists in particular, like in relationship to that Harvard case, for example,
right.
How I see a lot of Asian American writers and thinkers trying to interrogate their relationship to both whiteness and blackness in the U.S. now. So it's, you know, the question of what makes something political is very complicated and intricate. And I think sometimes we default to some of the more overt expressions of it. But I certainly agree with what Hamid says in that, you know, I was, after you sent me that quote, I went on a little bit of a hunt for what he's been saying recently. And he was, I found this interview with him in The Guardian, where he's talking basically about Pakistan and, you know, looking at America and Europe and telling them to look at Pakistan if they want to see where things are headed, if they don't address what is going on for them at home.
I'm excited to read the story now. It sounds amazing. On that note, I think it would be great to maybe preface the rest of our conversation with you reading from one of the essays in your book. One of my favorite essays in the book, which I've been using with my students this semester, and the essay is called On Becoming an American Writer. And the title is an homage to our mutual former teacher, James Allen McPherson, who taught all three of us and who wrote an essay with the same title years ago. And if you would read us just a little bit of that, that would be so great.
Sure. Thank you. Students often ask me whether I think they can be a writer. I tell them I don't know, because it depends first and foremost on whether you want to be one. This question is not as simple as it seems. The difficulties are many, even if you truly want to be a writer. What seems to separate those who write from those who don't is being able to stand it. I started with writers more talented than me, Annie Dillard had said in class to me when I took writing from her in college. And they're not writing anymore. I am. I remember as a student thinking, why wouldn't you do the work? What could possibly stop you? I began teaching writers in the fall of 1996 at a continuing education program based on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I called it the MASH unit of creative writing because you can't turn anyone away from your classes there. The program pays instructors what it has always paid them, even now, 20 years later. And they do so because there is always an MFA graduate like me who needs a first teaching job. And every other place that offers writing classes in New York is more or less like this. But I loved my students, and what I still value of this experience is that it was there I first discovered that good writing was, as Annie had said to us, very teachable. Talent mattered less, and it was made to seem to matter. I watched in my first classes as I applied techniques I'd been taught to students who seemed at first to be unlikely writers, and they turned into excellent ones. I learned a different kind of humility there in the face of their efforts, which I think still serves me as a teacher. You don't know who will make it and who will not, and students' previous work may or may not be an indicator of what they can do, good or bad. Most of what Annie had taught me was about habits of mind and habits of work. As long as these continued, I imagine, so would the writing. I will always want my students to know that if what you write matters enough, it makes no difference where you write it, or if you have a desk, or if you have quiet, and so on. If the essay or novel or poem wants to be written, it will speak to you while the conductor is calling out the streets. The question is, will you listen? And listen regularly. Teaching these classes, I also learned what could stop a writer. so many of the students in my classes were stuck. Some were struggling with a story they both wanted to tell and had forbidden themselves from telling. Some were struggling with a family story that they believed, if told, would destroy their family, or them, or their relationship to the family. A close friend to this day will not write the novel he wants to write about his late mother, who was closeted until he came out to her, and then she came out to him. He is afraid of the reaction of his single cousin. Why does the talented student of writing stop? It is usually the imagination turned to creating a story in which you are a failure, and all you have done is failed, and you are made out to be the fraud you feared you are. You can imagine the story you might tell, or you can imagine this other story. Both will be extraordinarily detailed, but only one will be something you can publish. The other will freeze you in place in a private theater of pain that seats one. These writers were, are, in many cases, people who know how to write. What they don't know is how to become unstuck, how to leave that theater they've made for themselves, how to stop telling themselves a story that freezes them. I discovered I needed to teach not just how to write, but how to keep writing, how to face up to who you think is listening. Is the person listening more important than you? Or is the story you would tell more important than you? I was teaching how to stand up and leave that room in your mind so you can go and write and live. But the question after that always is, live with what? And one answer was always going to be America.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. It's so interesting to me in that phrase of how to become unstuck, teaching someone how to do that. I noticed that in the answer you gave to us when I was asking you about the politics in your book, you mentioned a student story and deflected away from your own work, which is a very decent quality of yours.
Thank you.
But, we're asking you on here because the elections are about to come up. They're incredibly important. And you are and have been for a long time in your life one of the most politically active writers that I know. You know, your Facebook feed and your Twitter feed are always talking to people about what they can do and how they can get involved. And we're going to get to some of those specific suggestions later in the podcast. But I guess what I just realized, is that I never thought about this, but I'm going to ask you this. You know, it seems to me like you're saying, in a way, implicitly in that passage and in what you and the way you answer the question, that teaching writing is a political act also.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think, for example, James Allen McPherson, our teacher, actually believed that quite deeply. Not just teaching that writing, but also lifting those students up afterward, writing letters of recommendation for them, putting them up for awards, all the ways that you could support them, the way that you can support them, is about changing the culture.
Yeah.
Changing who gets to write a story, which changes who gets to hear the story as well.
I know that both of you have had experiences of this in your life, and I have too. When you write something that actually does make a difference politically, in some small way, and one of the things that I discover that I do with my students a lot is try to convince them that this can happen, that writing is one of the few ways to leverage power if you don't have money. Right. In other words, it's thing that's available to the people who are without power, because you can write it, as you said, anywhere. The story can come to you anywhere. And yet sometimes those stories can make a difference. Do you ever talk to your students directly about that? And I also wonder if Sugi does, too.
I mean, I don't, when I'm teaching them, I think, it's not something that I like start the class with, say, but I would say I build it into the class. I'm trying to think of, even just the idea of what a fiction class can do for a student, for example, especially in an undergraduate context. I talk to them about how it's very difficult to tell a story that you don't want to tell.
Right.
That you have to find something that you really want to tell in order to tell it well and tell it all the way to the end. And that in that sense, studying fiction writing, whether or not you go on to become a professional fiction writer, teaches you how to know what matters to you. And how to think your way around it as well. And to use your empathy and your imagination in the same process.
And when you talk about in your essay, teaching writers to get up and leave that theater of pain that seats one, I mean, is that what you're telling them? can you boil it down to a sentence that will save us all, Alex?
Well, you know, that question of like, who is listening? Who do you think is listening is huge. It's a huge question.
Yeah.
You know, and the, you know, one writer, Blanche McCrary Boyd, who's The Tomb of the Unknown Racist just came out this year. It's kind of an unsung hero of the season as a novel. You know, it's the end of a trilogy for her that she's been publishing and working on for 20 some years. And she's a lesbian activist. It's about a lesbian activist. It's about white supremacy and terrorism. When I met her in the 80s, she had a great answer to the question of like, who is listening, which was to just always imagine that you are speaking to the most intelligent person you know. And when you're writing a story, and never to think of anyone else, and that everybody else would catch up, you know. Marilyn Robinson had a kind of a funny answer, sort of an answer to the same question that I recall, you know, which was more about the question of like, how do you write if you think your family is going to read it, you know? And she said something effective like, you close the door and you imagine that everyone you know has died and could never respond. And it's a terrible tragedy and you just must go on without them. And then you open the door when you're done and they're alive again. And it's a miracle that you've written the thing that you had to write.
I think that's roughly, that's like a pretty good description of like, I mean, do you feel like that's what you do? I feel like that's a pretty good description of what I do. Sort of in the same way that when I go to the dentist, I sort of like fill every minute until I'm actually lying in the chair with work so that I can't think about what would happen. I mean, I'm actually not that afraid of the dentist, so it's maybe not like the best metaphor, but I think that I just like, you know, I try not to, in a way that I'm sure is in some flip side problematic, I try not to think about consequences when I'm writing, or not to think about consequences for me at any rate of what I'm writing. And, I don't know. It's to think about when you were asking about just kind of how we talk about this in the classroom. And I mean, I remember Jim McPherson talking to us about, I mean, he would really explicitly encourage us to kind of write about big things.
As would Marilyn.
Yeah.
It was why she wanted us to read theology, philosophy. You know, she wanted us, I remember her saying that she wanted us to think bigger than just the sort of like domestic drama. Even if we were going to still write domestic dramas, at least we would have these these other themes in our mind.
While we're talking political, American political novelists, I wanted to bring up an article that was in Lit Hub, our parent and partner, by Susan Zakin, if I'm pronouncing her name right, called Why America's Best Political Novelist is Required Reading in 2018. And she says that novelist is Ward Just, whose work I'm very familiar with. But she also goes on to say, American writers long ago ceded the ground to international authors such as Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Camila Shamsi, and Gail Faye. What do you think of that? Is it true? Are there no more American political writers left, or are there others that you think should be on that list than Ward Just? It's a loaded question, Alexander.
I know. I still get to laugh at it.
I'm going to put you on that list. I'm going to nominate you to be on that list first.
Well, you know, I think that like it's the question is always like, what do you think politics are? You know, and I with all respect to Susan Zakin, who I do respect tremendously. You know, I don't know that I see her argument exactly You know, I think I've certainly had conversations about how the American literary establishment often turns to international writers of color before they turn to American writers of color to celebrate. And so, you know, you have the sort of elevation and celebration of these writers who, I'm not taking away any of their literary qualities, but like we have homegrown writers of color who are treated as minor regionalists of a very minor kind by the same literary establishment. And so that's, you know, whatever's going on with Ward Just, you know, there was a thinly veiled shot about like, you know, how if he were more successful, we might call what he has privilege. And I saw that line and I thought, oh, no, he has privilege for sure. Like anybody who can be, quote unquote, ignored for that long and still be publishing novels is doing just great, I think.
I also wondered if maybe
in this economy.
Yeah. If she was defining a political novel in this very narrow way, meaning that it was specifically about politicians, you know, because I don't think that's what makes a novel political, that it has politicians as characters, you know.
I mean, is that what Ward Just writes about? I don't
Basically,
actually know his work very well.
Yeah, he writes about, you know, like the inner circle of Washington, D.C., politicians, people involved in politics, ambassadors, that kind of stuff. You know, that's what his work is about.
Oh, I see.
But I think if you were to look at, I mean, you know, I would say, well, why is Claudia Rankine not, you know, a political writer? You know,
tremendously political writer. Yeah.
Or Yusuf Komunyakaa. I mean, what, you know, how come that's not politics? And so anyway,
that's what I mean about questions. Like, you know, anytime that the writer is also engaging with identity, it's often certain establishment types will treat it like it's not really political, quote unquote. I won't see that point.
Yeah.
Should people read Ward Just more? Sure.
We're sort of, this is not really a referendum on Ward Just. This is an opening to bring in other writers that we think could be involved in that conversation.
I
don't know. I can't tell you how happy I am that, like, first of all, I just love having you on the show. Also, I mean, I think, you know, that point about like the sort of the centering of whiteness, the unspoken centering of whiteness always. And the way that that's coded in sort of like, you know, the things that are marginal and the things that are not marginal, the things that are, or in this case, the things that are considered political and not political is so important. And I think I remember reading Camilla Shamsi's Guernica essay from a few years ago where she talked about, you know, she was writing about the storytellers of empire, which was a call for writers and novelists to kind of avoid American imperialism and to look sort of introspectively at the effects of American imperialism on other countries. I think one of the things I admire most about your work is the ways that you challenge people to also read better and to think about the ways that not only what we write, but also how thoughtfully we read. And you, you know, also purposely when you were reading from your essay, you ended with, you know, and one of the things we have to live with is America. So I'm really interested to hear you talk about that.
I was very moved by a story that someone told me while I was on tour of a couple in South Korea. One was a white American soldier. The other was a gay South Korean man. And they had a book club meeting in their home and invited their friends over and chose my book as the book that they were going to read. And they did so because they wanted to test the reaction of their friends to the material to see whether or not they could be out to them. And that was just a kind of, it was really amazing to me to have created a book that could play that role in their lives all those years ago. And it's the kind of thing that, again, like, what do you see as political, you know? There's a way in which I'm sure, because, you know, my first novel doesn't deal with the effects of empire, might fall into the category of what Camilla Shamsi is criticizing here. you know, and I also know that certainly, like, there's a way in which, you know, when you ask American writers to go and write about, you know, what our soldiers are doing overseas, that that work often gets criticized for being as colonialist as the soldiers themselves. It's very difficult to try to dictate the terms of somebody else's literature. You know, like, what is the writer going to write about? You know, I think that American parochialism comes more from publishing than it comes from the writers. That oftentimes people act as if these books just aren't being written, when the question they should be asking themselves is, are these books just not being published? Or are they being published and then no one is talking about them?
You know? Yeah.
And that's another conversation, you know.
I do think that's interesting to talk about. Yeah, like whether or not publishers think those kind of works will sell, you know? I mean,
right.
Including, like, Iraqis' points of view in The Good Lieutenant was not something that guaranteed to make the book sell better, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, no, exactly. This is exactly.
Yeah, your work is the right example point. For that.
Yeah.
All right, so to bring this home to the current election, which races in your area, Alexander, on the East Coast and around New York, and I guess we could include New Hampshire, are you watching most closely? What issues that seem to be most on folks' radars there?
Well, I mean, here in New York, I think we are very concerned with getting rid of what's called the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus, which, quote unquote, which was not particularly, it was only independent in the sense that they were Democrats who caucused with Republicans in Albany and prevented most progressive changes from happening in the legislature. They were supported by Cuomo in this process, and it allowed him to act the part of the defeated progressive in office. So he could say, well, I wanted to do it, but the Senate just won't let us do it. And then,
yeah,
you know, so, and this little charade has been going on for quite a while. The corruption involved is pretty disgusting, and, you know, involves, like, state money that these candidates have, or these officials have accessed inappropriately, and anyway, we want them out. I think the thing that one of the messages or lessons of the last 2 years is the importance that liberals need to place on local politics.
Yes.
So we have allowed for too long, you know, everything from the school board to the town council, to, you know, going straight on up, to be left to the right wing. Cynthia Nixon's campaign was, I think, widely misunderstood by people who are not in New York, and also still misunderstood by people in New York. She did exceedingly well for a political novice. You know, his little defeated progressive campaign just didn't hold up to the intense scrutiny that she regularly provided. And it says a lot that his support for the IDC caucus collapsed as soon as she pointed out the relationship.
I think that's such helpful analysis. So much of what Sri Lankan activists that I know and respect have talked about for years has been kind of like a really, really long arc of planning, which seems to me like it sometimes comes up on the conservative side and less so for progressives and even for liberals, which I would identify as distinct populations. And like listening to you talk, I'm just reminded of the ways in which, like, of course I want progressive candidates to win, but it's also true that like I feel like Cynthia Nixon's campaign, as you say, like made a difference. It illuminated things that needed to be illuminated, and she didn't win, but that also was still so important. You know, we're taping this episode the day after the Tree of Life synagogue shootings, which were so tragic and awful, and which were in some ways incited by a kind of by racist rhetoric, and of course, like the migrant caravan also being connected to that. It's getting a lot of attention, and it's given Trump another opportunity to prey on anti-immigrant sentiment. You know, he's again sort of talking about the wall. And how do you think that the Tree of Life shootings and the caravan will factor into the election?
It's a real wild card, to be honest. It's such a huge tragedy. It's staggering to think about. I think that, you know, I was in shock yesterday. I'm still in shock about it. It's, you know, these people were pretty much almost all over the age of 50. Some of the, by account, in terms of like as the stories are coming out about them, just like astonishingly gentle and wonderful people. And it's,
but they were targeted because they specifically had organized to help immigrants,
yeah,
right? Isn't that the deal? Isn't that the name of the society that the shooter was upset about in his social media posts?
You know, from the beginning, Trump had anti-Semites in his campaign and his administration, even as he also had very powerful Jewish people as well. And, you know, a lot of people on Twitter pointed out that the shooter at the synagogue hated Trump because of his Jewish son-in-law and his daughter also having converted, also now a Jew. So it's just this like weird knot of these things that he created in these different spaces, or that he elevated in these different spaces, that have met in this horrible way. And so it requires, yes, voting, but also like all kinds of repudiation of this horrific behavior.
Yeah, just
to, and just to, just go, as a point of fact, it's that he was talking specifically about HIAS,
yeah,
which was planning a Shabbat ceremony for refugees in locations around the country. That's according to the Times coverage of it. There's a big story about it.
Yeah, a man with Bauer's name had posted anti-Semitic statements on social media before the shooting, expressing anger that a nonprofit Jewish organization in the neighborhood that has helped refugees settle in the United States. So that's from the post. That's what I'm looking at.
And yeah, I think it's, you know, voter suppression seems like also a huge concern, specifically in Georgia.
27 states, actually. According to the, there's an independent journalist named Greg Palast, who's been on the case, and his efforts have been getting more attention recently. But yeah, it's no one should think it's just Georgia. And,
well, we're going to have, Missouri's going to have a voter ID, law that is now going to be, it's been used in some smaller elections, but now this is the first sort of major election that'll be happening. And there's also been a lot of stories in Kansas about how they closed down all the polling places in Dodge City, which is a very heavily Latino town, and then put one polling place sort of outside of town that has no access but to public transportation. So there's been a lot of that going on around here.
I was greatly heartened to see that, you know, Lyft is offering free rides to the polls on Election Day. I think we all have to do more. We all have to think about becoming not just people who say go vote, but like people who do just a little bit more in advance to make sure that all this happens. Like talking to the people we know. About, you know, if the state has a voter ID law, do they have their IDs that they need? You know, Wisconsin just threw like several hundred thousand people off the rolls there as well, for example. You know, it's because they have this system there where if you move They send you a postcard, and if you don't respond to the postcard, then they take you off the voting rolls.
One of the things that I really like about, and I appreciate it, about what you talk about in posts is that you very often are offering like concrete things to do. Other than just saying I'm mad. I mean, when Trump does something that is infuriating, and then people post that I'm mad, I'm like, well, that's not really going to do a lot of good. Just being mad. And I wondered if you could talk about that, Alex, you know, practical things that we should be paying attention to between now and November 6th as voters.
Sure. You know, I think there's certainly been a campaign promoted on Twitter by an activist by the name of Celeste Peuter, who has talked about her like adopt a senator campaign, where you find a senator in a close race and you do what you can to help them. Can you donate money? If not, can you donate some time? Can you text voters for that person? Can you make phone calls for that person? If you live in that person's area, can you go door to door for them? You could also get trained as an election poll worker and do that also. For example, I saw a young person, 17 years old, who had gotten herself trained. She can't vote in this election, but it means a lot to her. This was her way of contributing. She signed up to be a poll worker. There's a lot of these kinds of civic things that we've all neglected while we've been staring at our phones for the last 15 years that need our attention, basically. So I think certainly there's been a lot of conversations about how young people have got to get out and vote, and how the 18 to 35 age group is the least represented in terms of voting. And
that's the podcast. Okay. That's our podcast's biggest demographic. So you're speaking to them right now.
Well, you know, I think certainly like there have been a lot of moves to delegitimize the votes of college students. So, you know, there's a lot you can do as a college student still to see how you can protect your vote. It's certainly going to be a demoralizing hassle that comes near the end of the semester or the end of the term. But it's also just so incredibly important to get it done. You know, I've even considered, you know, giving my students permission to miss class if it turns out they have to in order to vote. Certainly a lot of the sort of social pressure of, you know, do you have your voting plan, posting about that on social media, that also helps. And people who haven't maybe thought through how they're going to vote can see what you've done to prepare to vote. And that will help them to prepare to vote and even put it on their radar to do.
Those all seem like great concrete things we can do as we head into the midterms. And as you point out, beyond. Alexander, thank you so much for being with us. It's always heartening to talk to you. And I have to tell you, this morning I was in a totally grumpy mood, and I was like, I'm going to look at Alexander's book to see what we can talk about. And I immediately felt sort of so much better. So if you haven't picked up this book or Alexander's other work, we encourage our listeners to do that and also to get out the vote. And Alexander, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate getting asked back. It's nice to talk to you guys.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the News tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week there, on Facebook at FNFPod, and on Twitter at FNFTalk. Happy reading, and don't forget, on November 6th, you gotta stop reading and vote.